Glad where the schmooze is back. We're here. I'm here with Michel Barak, who's a principal and founder of Kivun, an advisor to three Israeli prime ministers, and his firm does polling and political analysis for bodies within Israel and outside Israel, and some very prominent clients, and can be easily seen in foreign media, Bloomberg, CNN, Al Jazeera, for his views on Israeli politics. As well, welcome Rabbi Shimon Felix again, a senior educator who's left a mark all over the world and within Israel. Glad to see Shimon. Shimon is the principal now and founder of his own tour company, which has tourists, deals with young tourists coming to Israel, called RE-IL. Our first topic will be Amnesty International, produced a scathing report calling Israel an apartheid state, outlining what it views as human rights abuses of the state of Israel, calling for an international embargo on the state of Israel with regard to arms, and calling for the prosecution of Israeli officials for the violation of civil rights. Shimon, I understand that you weren't exactly happy with the nature of the report and its tone.
Correct. Very unhappy, in fact. Look, you can't use the word apartheid, even with all kinds of attempts to explain. We don't really mean that's exactly what South Africa was back in the day. But still, the word has that, you know, genesis. That's where it comes from, and it was what it was. It was a very specific system of oppression and murder and racism. And to use that word is just, you know, I don't think that these nice people who spend their lives trying to help human rights out, I don't think that they're really dyed-in-the-wool anti-Semites. But I'm going to say the word anti-Semites. And I don't love calling everybody who criticizes Israel anti-Semite. And a lot of times it's certainly not true. But here the effect is, I think, because of it's so over the top, to use that very highly charged and very specific historically, very specific word that's so ridiculous towards Israel, it leaves one scratching one's head. Like, what were they thinking? What got them to use such a highly charged word about a country who is not a colonial power, who marched in and murdered the indigenous people? Rather, we are people who see ourselves as indigenous, and, you know, the case can certainly be made. There are people who deny our indigeneity, people who argue about it, but we can certainly make that case. And the Palestinians argue that they're indigenous, and that's where we are. We're not with these, you know, a clear case of these are the good guys, these are the bad guys, these people were here first, these people came in as conquerors, so it's clear what should happen. Anyone who thinks that simplistic kind of formula makes any sense here, which seems to be what Amnesty is buying into, that there is a wrongness about the state of Israel, and by the way, not just in the West Bank or Gaza, but there seems to be a wrongness in the creation in 1948 of the state, and a kind of ethnocentric, the Jews have to always be in charge and they are privileged in a way that is unacceptable, and that's apartheid. I see that as a real misunderstanding of the context here in the Israeli-Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Explicitly, they state that they view the state, the Arabs within the state of Israel, as being discriminated against,
right,
with regard to resources, with regard to their treatment by the state, in many ways. So they view it as this sort of general issue, and they go out of their way as well to mention Gaza, which sort of for me set off some kind of alarm bells in light of the frequent missile attacks. Mitchell, if you could weigh in.
Well, you know, I'll take some, first of all, of opposition to Rabbi Felix calling it anti-Semitism. He joins the long list of Israeli leaders who you know, have a reflex of anything that's against Israel is anti-Semitic. Not everything is anti-Semitic. Not every ice cream company that doesn't want to sell to places in Israel and you can't buy Cherry Garcia and Efrat means they're anti-Semitic. Sometimes they just want to make a moral stance, and it may not be our moral stance. And, you know, Ben and Jerry's, you can say what you want. They've been on the moral front for decades. Mm-hmm. So now they're against us. So we're against them, and we call them anti-Semite. And I think that was a mistake of the Israeli leaders. The Israeli leaders came out. I know Yair Lapid and others. That this is before the report even came out. This is anti-Semitic. This is against Israel. Instead of saying, which is really the truth, Amnesty has spent decades fighting for human rights all over the world. Now, in most of the places, we probably agree with them. In Israel, we probably don't agree with them, but they are dedicated to human rights, and we should have invited them to kind of give a more balanced report and to work with us to try and fight specific things and to work on that. Now, when it comes to apartheid, it's the wrong language. The only thing I will say about that is it's a great reminder that we will have peace with the Palestinians when the Palestinians will elect a Nelson Mandela on the one hand, and the Israelis will finally elect someone like F.W. de Klerk that can work with Mandela and can say, it's time for us to compromise, it's time for us to give up. I don't think we're going to get it on our side. We're just so used to blaming the Palestinians that they don't have a Mandela. We don't have a de Klerk either. What I will say also, you know, and I think they conflated things and confused it by saying that Palestinians on the West Bank are the same as Palestinians in Israel. There is equal rights in Israel for Palestinians. For Israeli Arabs, there is an Israeli Arab party that's part of the government, which was unprecedented. You know, you maybe can say all Israelis are equal. Some are a little bit more better off than others. But there is equality here. You can't really make that argument. I will say that one of Netanyahu's greatest failures when he procured the vaccine for all Israelis was that he ignored trying to get the vaccine for the Palestinians, who are just 15 minutes away here by car. Meaning he could have done that. He could have been helpful. It is kind of one group, and I think he lost an opportunity. The last thing I'll say, though, is the Jerusalem Arabs, I know it came up in the report, is that that's a real issue where you can use harsh terminology because there's 200 or 250 or 300,000 Arabs that were Jordanian citizens that in 67, we took over those territories. We offered them citizenship at the time. They didn't take it. 90% of those people are dead. And the ones that are applying now, there's maybe 1,000, 2,000 a year that apply. Most of those people, they can vote in municipal elections, although most of them choose not to, but they can't vote in national Knesset elections. So no one in this country, no one in the Knesset is representing them. That's a real problem. That's what they should have focused on. And that's our weak spot.
If I could just point to one of the two things that Mitchell said, look, I certainly agree that calling every critique and every critic and every criticism of Israel anti-Semitism is just plain silly. However, you know, sometimes there is, one wonders, what could motivate an apparently serious and well-known and you know, long-standing organization like Amnesty to, in my opinion, get it so wrong? And, you know, who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? You know, we don't know exactly what animates me. I don't know what animates me all the time. I really don't know what gets me to think and feel and say the things I always say. But there's just a strangeness to me about the position Amnesty has taken. With Ben and Jerry's, I mean, I was laughing most of the time when the story began. But then it turns out that there's a woman, I believe she's Indian, perhaps, you know, from
the
India.
CEO.
Yeah, the CEO, who really does seem to have some serious animus towards Israel in a way that goes beyond the norm. And that's the tricky thing. And I'll just finish with this piece. The temperature of much of the criticism of Israel seems so inordinately high sometimes. You know, one can be accused of whataboutism for saying what I'm about to say, but there are so many more awful crimes against humanity happening all the time, usually in our neighborhood. And you do just have to wonder sometimes, so what inspires them to be so hate-filled against Israel, when really what looked at, I think, reasonably and in context, you have two nationalist movements, the Jewish one, the Palestinian one, who are in competition and do nasty things to one another, usually, you know, often, unfortunately. Right. And let's, as you said, Mitchell, let's try to work it out. You know, an honest broker should be trying to work it out. A friend of mine, Jonathan Kessler, likes to say, I'm not sure if he made it up, to better rather than batter Israel. Why aren't people working on that a little bit more? And sometimes I think the battering impulse comes from something strange.
Maybe it's just good business, you know, Amnesty. Just like yes. There's five Jewish organizations that only deal with this anti-Semitism, and they have to outcry.
It's the flip side of the ADL. It's the flip side of Wiesenthal Center. They need each other.
But listen, they definitely have, you know, what to offer. I also think that we haven't thought out this boycott strategy in that, you know, now state pension funds have to divest from Unilever, meaning there's a few problems with this now. Is first of all, Unilever has been going at this for a long time and they don't care. And they've lost a lot of value in stock. Every Israeli advocate thinks it's because of, you know, the ice cream. It almost has nothing to do with the ice cream because their business model has tanked. They may be taken over by actually a Jewish person, which is interesting that someone should make money off of this. But, you know, their stock has tanked because their business has been bad. So now, if you're in a pension fund, okay, I'm in the Illinois, said they're going to divest out of Unilever. They could be losing money. Now, if I have money in the pension fund, I'm going to be hell angry at Israel for taking money out of my pension fund, for selling at a loss, or for selling and then the stock goes up. Did anyone think this through? I don't think so.
They just, by the way, I just saw it today, that the same Indian a woman who's, I think, I don't know if she's chairman of the board of Ben & Jerry's or this particular committee, Ben & Jerry's posted either on Facebook or Twitter, basically criticizing the United States, saying you can't send troops to Europe and call for peace in the Ukraine at the same time. Now, why you can't do those things at the same time, I kind of understand the point, but and then she was rebuked by, not personally, by Unilever and say that don't opine on things of which you have no particular knowledge. Okay, I'll give my Bemet two cents. First of all, I agree with Shimon that the report, I mean, I read a summary of the report, but it doesn't give any context. Like, it starts in 1948, like 1948, and that's it. So what happened before 1948? There's no reference in the report to the war in which occurred, the invasion of 48, and basically the breach of the United Nations resolution and what had been an agreement. There's no context of what happened in 67, which led to the situation now. So from their point of view, that's very suspect. But I want to raise something, which is, you know, again, it's hard to ignore, at least, the treatment of Arab citizens, particularly in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem. There was a case, you know, Elor Azaria, a soldier who, there was a terrorist, he was rightfully shot, he was lying on the ground, he was completely unconscious, the soldier kills him, you know, walks up, shoots him, and the next thing you know, the soldier's family is getting calls from our Minister of Justice, the Prime Minister. He's almost, you know, cause celeb, and were it not for the Ramatkal, who had a backbone, the head of the Israeli army, he may have got off virtually scot-free. We just had a case in which an 80-year-old man is trying to cross a mahzom, a barrier. He wasn't happy. I guess he was vocal in saying, you know, why are you stopping me? Why are you hassling me? I've seen people being stopped at roadblocks in Israel, in the Gush for absolutely nothing and being harassed. That could have happened in his case. They handcuff him, they put him in a building, he freezes to death and suffers a heart attack. There was a case of famous...
He didn't freeze to death.
But
he was cold and he had a heart attack.
Yeah, but... Okay.
Freezing to death is one thing.
Okay.
The most moral army in the world. Sometimes, right. You know, the cost of keep defending the citizens of Israel or the citizens who have settled in various places... It's very high. There's a moral price that seems to be here.
Yeah, I think, you know, I could go on. I was just going to give, you know, the case of the autistic young man who was shot in the old city. And then there's the Tag Mahir, burning Arab cars in the West Bank. destroying olive fields, assaults, kidnapping, temporary kidnappings, and these type of things. So I agree with Mitch. The price is very, very high, and it's kind of ignored. And then you had state racism. I mean, you had they talk in the report about racism in Israel. So it occurs, and I agree with Shimon. Are we the poster child for racism in the world? No. Israel's in many respects a very tolerant society, both of its portions of its Arab population, minorities within Israel, much more tolerant than other societies. But when the prime minister of the country says, you know, they're streaming to the polls, and then now we have the cases saying, look, they're sitting in the same government with this guy, Abbas, which is a real achievement for him and for Israel, and all Israel should be proud of it. And for his own political gain, you know, he's attacking an arrangement which he desired to basically to have. And then the Haredi party say, and the Likud is saying, you're giving all this money to him as if
Abbas Hamas,
as if he's getting the money. Right. And it's the report talks about the fact that within Israel, the Arab sector has been badly underfunded. In other words, just civil rights, civil needs that come, they haven't received. So now they're saying, yeah, the guy has, you know, it's like, he came to us, he said, look, you really should have funded all these things. And now we're giving him the money. And they're saying, well, you're giving these Arab terrorists, you're giving Hamas all this money. So I'm saying it's hard to ignore certain aspects of the report, because I agree with you, the inflammatory language and the fact that Israel is particularly vulnerable. In other words, despite the fact that we're this, you know, sort of military superpower, we're not China, we're not Russia, pressure can be exerted on us from all sorts of angles and forces. But nevertheless, it's hard with some of their factual statements to argue with them that there is a certain racism. And it, you can argue that it's less among the everyday citizens of Israel and Jerusalem who, you know, Arab nurses, doctors, pharmacists, people in restaurants who meet with Israelis, work with Israelis. There's less racism there than there is with our former prime minister and a big party in our government. So it's hard to, you know, ignore those issues. And just one final thing, I agree with Mitch that one of the things I admired so much about Shimon Peres, who we work with, is Peres always put the ball in the Arabs' court. He was always making offers, you know, of some kind. You know, he was saying, let's have another vada, and I propose this, and let's get it going. And then he put the ball on the Palestinian side, okay, and the Arab side. What are you guys bringing to the table? But now we have a situation because the Likud just operates on fear. So they say, we can't make an offer, mafitom to make an offer. So we're kind of stuck because of Israel's internal political dynamic. And until we have a leader and we have maturity in our population and we have maturity on the other side, we're not going to resolve this issue.
Let me say one thing about Shimon Peres, because it was one of the most exciting parts of my career. Cares about Israel. So he used to say in meetings when, you know, people say Oslo was a failure, thousands of Israelis were killed, he says, listen, peace is like business. If you take risks and you don't take gambles, that's what motivated him, was that you have to take risks. Looked into his biography he gave me to read when I got there, and he goes from the 1950s when he was the director general of the defense ministry all through his career, when he was going to France and buying jets and nuclear reactors and so forth. I got the first quote in his obituary in Bloomberg, and I said I could sum him up in one sentence: Hine lo yanum velo yishan shomer Yisrael. The guy was always thinking about the future. Or in peace.
You know, I think there's some interesting things were said. You, Leon, mentioned Israel's vulnerability, and you mentioned how the Likud works on fear. And you, Mitchell, just now mentioned how Shimon Peres took risks and said, just like in business, to make peace, you have to take risks, which he certainly did. Oslo was a risk, and Didn't work out. Didn't push the ball down the field or back towards the other goal line. Who knows? I think this is a crucial, crucial piece that, although I think most people sort of get it and understand it, and I don't think we clarify sufficiently, which is the following. The Amnesty Report and a lot of the kind of pressure the left puts and the pro-Palestinian organizations put on Israel about apartheid and racism and colonialism and it's, you know, the way we treat the Arabs, either in the West Bank or in Israel or whatever, really doesn't give sufficient weight to what I am pretty sure is the real problem here, which is the problem of fear, which you know, Leon, you sort of dismiss it. Well, they could, they play, you know, they play up on the fear, etc. I think the average Israeli, and you know, Mitchell's a pollster, so I could be wrong with what I'm about to say. He'll let me know, I'm sure, if I'm right or wrong. But my sense has been since Oslo, in the 90s, that the average Israeli gets it, that the two-state solution seems to be, you know, you ask a 10-year-old or a 50-year-old, how do you solve this? So, you know, you put the Palestinians there, you know, you give them a state there, and the Jews have a state there, and that looks like a solution. And Oslo was based on that, and we were moving in that direction. On the other hand, I think the average Israeli also thinks that, well, we tried and we got terror. And in Gaza, we did this really crazy risk, and we just pulled out, and it was one-sided, and it was unilateral, and maybe that was the mistake. Although that, to me, sounds like an excuse. We pulled out, and we gave them autonomy, and people tend to forget, but they were not blockaded, certainly not to the extent they are now, by Israel and Egypt at the beginning. The borders were relatively open at the beginning. They had to be closed because Hamas took over and the terror and the violence became unbearable. And so Israelis put that two and two together. They say, I guess a two-state solution is the solution, but I'm afraid. I'm simply afraid. And I have said this. I brought a group to meet another bunch of people. I sort of found myself at a kind of a peace now / merits meeting. It's not where I usually go, you know. And they were talking, and I felt I had to say, guys, I'm not a member, you know. Until you seriously address the very real and very reasonable fears. Look what happened in Gaza. Hamas took over. That's what will happen in Judea and Samaria. Why not? Explain to me why not. Until you feel that you can't just dismiss all the fear-mongering, and there is plenty of fear-mongering. But, you know, paranoids can also have enemies. And people who have been fear-mongered to can have legitimate fears and legitimate concerns. And that, to me, you know, I'm not the first guy to say this, obviously, but that, to me, in a nutshell, is the rock and the hard place that we find ourselves between. The understanding of the two-state solution is probably the only solution, and the fear to move, and coming over what you both said, even a little step forward. Let's try something. Let's offer something. But what if they say yes? And we give them things. And the Hamas takes over. We have rockets on Jerusalem, rockets on Tel Aviv. I don't think the left and the reasonable Israeli critics take that into account sufficiently.
I think that, I've often been my whole person, you know, I've been very concerned with security. I never make light of it, of legitimate security concerns. I don't think there's any magic solution, but I think not trying for solutions and saying there's no partner on the other side for what people have done for political reasons. I talk about good lines, and Mitchell, I used to say when there was no terror, and sometimes there's been no terror attacks for long periods of time in Israel, we say, why should we give anything back? They're weak. You see this, like they're not causing us any problems. These people who can't even launch a terrorist attack. Now, and when there's terror, we say, you see, there's the terrorists.
I think that's a good point.
I think there's a big price, opportunity cost, a negative opportunity cost, or an opportunity cost is negative, for not doing anything, and the numbers, what's happening on in the Shtachim, the fact that we have movement now, like it's gone beyond fear. It's much more, I look at it as the fusion of right-wing religious messianic nationalism has the Likud has taken it because it's seen that you can win to a certain degree. You can run on it. You can win on it, and it's become mainstream the Likud. So this is not just fear. This is let's take it all over. And I think that movement has to be stopped. I think that movement is deadly for Israel's PR. I mean, PR sounds like a cold-hearted term, but in the long term, it's deadly for us, for our image in the world. It propagates the dispute, and I don't think we can go on forever. So I agree with you. You have to find someone, and that's what Mitch was saying. You have to find someone who's responsible on the other side. But you have to keep on working for it. You have to keep on building bridges. You have to keep on trying to find things that you can agree with. And if you see that, again, and that was my point, that if you see that the other side, the Palestinian side, is intransigent, or there's no leader there who will say, this is what we'll agree to, this is what we won't agree to. So at least for public appearance purposes, say this is what we're prepared to do. Actually say, this is what we're prepared to do, so that your image changes in the world, because then you can come to people around the world and say, we're prepared to do this, and we have these concerns, and the other side is not prepared to do these things. But if you want to go ahead with what could happen in another couple of years, Likud gets back into power and nationalize the whole West Bank again, Yehuda V'Shomron,
the plan,
that's the plan. We're going in a very bad direction. So I agree with you. Fear is, it's a strong political motivator. It's tough, very tough to overcome. I was at a peace forum, and I asked all these ex-generals, I said, how do you overcome that? The Likud pays upon this fear, and they did not have an answer. So I don't have an answer for that, how you change the Israeli internal dynamic, but you have to think of ways to do it, because if you don't do it, I don't think that the end result is a good end result the way we're going. Okay. Mitch. Go ahead.
Can I add one thing? So the only thing I'll say is, I think you're right in public opinion now. People are not enough. I think the Abraham Accords opens it up. A lot of those countries feel that abandon the Palestinians to a certain extent, and now we know we don't need to make a Palestinian state in order to get the other countries. We have them already. So when they start putting pressure on Israel to do something, and they can pull, plus we may have an issue. What I will say, which I think is interesting, is, and you and I studied the Yeshivat Miftar in 1987. The first Intifada started in December. We were in El Azhar, which was right before Efrat. It was a difficult time. We saw the Intifada, the rocks being thrown and all that. When I go out with my kids to Efrat for the last 10, 20 years almost, every time we pass Efrat, I always tell them, I say, you see what's going on here? When I was in Yeshiva, 1987 Yeshivat HaMiftar, only those two hills were populated. Here, almost nothing was there. Look at it today. And then at some point, it clicked. No. There's a guy my age whose name is Muhammad, and he also was here in 1987. And he tells his kids the exact opposite. And he says, do you see these hills? When I was in high school, when I was studying at Birzeit University, wherever, there was nothing here. There was nothing here. There were no tunnels. It was impossible, the roadway. Now look at it. Look at what they've taken over. And the only thing I think we're missing the most, we see them, we don't hear their claim, we don't hear their pain. And until we can see what their perspective is and listen, I don't think we're so absorbed in our own rights and our own God-given biblical rights to the land that we're not.
If I could take a minute, I'd to expand a little bit on this and with. You said also, Leon, it seems to me that there's a legitimate right-wing position and a legitimate left-wing position and obviously a legitimate middle somehow, whatever that magic middle is. And as you pointed out, people who are not, I don't know, what's the expression? Bad players? Not bad players. What's the expression?
Actors, bad actors.
Bad actors, thank you. Bad actors. Take the right-wing position and just run with it to some crazy place. And people on the left who are bad actors take the left position and run with it to some crazy place. You know, Jews should all move back to Germany, Poland, America, wherever. Shouldn't be Jews in the Middle East. They don't belong here. You know, some crazy place. And all attempts at nuance and compromise and, as Mitch said, listening and hearing the other guy's story and hearing the other guy's position, it becomes lost in this ridiculous war of the extreme positions. And that's the tragedy, that, you know, the center is not holding, that the people in the middle of the road are getting run over by the people who are driving from the right and driving from the left. And as you said, Leon, I agree with you, they're doing it for political reasons. And to watch the weaponization of words like progressive and liberal and reform, which is so imitative of Trump's America, and this attempt to brand anyone, I've always thought the two-state solution is the solution. And I know that there are guys out there who think I'm an anti-Zionist, I'm an anti-Semite, I'm against Israel, for saying, no, that's going to save Israel. There's no other way. The Democrats are going to offer it. That, to me, is a political / linguistic / intellectual problem. That somehow the extremes are setting the tone and determining the parameters of the argument. And the middle has to somehow, as Mitch said, you know, we have to listen to the other guy and understand where they are and also express in reasonable ways where we are if we want to get anywhere.
So for our second topic tonight, I'd like to talk about something that for a few weeks ago was, of course, big news in Israel. Everything is big news in Israel. Everything is a crisis, and it really truly is. And then we live in interesting times, and then a week later we have another crisis. And that was our Attorney General, Mandelblit, had made a quiet deal with, it appeared, with Netanyahu's lawyers, who enlisted former Chief Justice of Israel as also supportive of this agreement, by which Netanyahu would plead guilty to several criminal charges in various cases against him, not receive any jail time, be prohibited from holding public office for a number of years, and receive probation. And the story, there's no journalist, I think, who matches Israeli journalists for ferreting out the truth. Mandelblit had only told it to four other people, told this about this agreement to four other people, or consulted with him, and they signed on, but the prosecutors on the case itself had not been informed. And when the story broke, it became quite clear that vast segments of the population were not in favor of this agreement, were totally opposed, and that there was great opposition within the line, prosecutors in the Justice Department and people in the Justice Department and in the legal community. And that proposed settlement, which thankfully I think fell through, was just part of a number of settlements that Mandelblit has entered into. I think one of the most egregious ones was with the former Minister of Health, Yaakov Litzman. Yaakov Litzman basically suborned perjury. I would not perjury because there actually wasn't a court case, but he interfered in the administration of justice, obstructed the administration of justice by getting a court-appointed psychiatrist basically to change his testimony to a court and therefore get Malka Leifer declared legally incompetent so she couldn't be extradited to Australia. That almost worked, but the police thankfully investigated it. So the deal again was very similar, that he would do no jail time, that he'd be put on probation, that he'd step down from public office. And then we had another deal with Aryeh Deri, this would have been his second felony, not felony, he's actually had a few felonies in his first go-round, but his second breach of the law, in which he blatantly tried to cheat the tax department for sales of apartments. Again, a sweetheart deal. where he supposedly steps down from politics. He doesn't go to jail. He receives a fine. And then Derry, after basically saying yes, he acknowledges his guilt, and he's going to step aside from politics, and he feels personally responsible, etc., etc. The next day, after he's receives the sweetheart deal, which is endorsed by the judge, goes off to say that if his name wasn't Arye Makhlouf Derry, he wouldn't have been investigated in the first place, that they spilled his blood, and they were basically out to get him, how unfairly he had been treated. But of course, maybe those things are minor in respect to Benjamin Netanyahu. The whole case raises so many issues. First of all, Mandelblit, according to the investigators, basically approved every daily, every piece of evidence, every hakira, which to me, it wasn't as if he was trying to obstruct the investigation. It's just so bizarre. And so everything was completely drawn out. And then another interesting thing that he did was that the simplest tik, the tik ha-matanot, in which Netanyahu has absolutely no legal defense, was told so by Weinrot. There's no legal defense under the law with regard to that tik. He bundled all the indictments together, even though they're separate sets of facts. Some of the players are the same, but some of them are different. And there are different events which occurred in different frameworks of time. And he bundled them together. So what did he do by that? He wasted a lot of time. In other words, till the investigation's all completed, by making that decision, it took at least about another year. And now we have a situation where also, where Netanyahu, again, according to Haaretz, which I think has done a fantastic job in exposing these investigations, the trial is taking about two times the length of trials of similar nature. Even the Olmert case, which was pretty sophisticated, pretty complicated case with regard to what happened in Jerusalem here with regard to a real estate development, took much less time. And they said that this case is going to take at least 3 years. It's taking probably double because the judges are allowing cross-examination whose only purpose is to delay. It's just like completely fruitless. If you read the right-wing media every day, they're saying the case is collapsing. Nonsense. The case is not collapsing. Netanyahu didn't race. It was he who initiated a deal. And the case isn't collapsing by any stretch of the imagination. But just the fact that Mandelblit could be persuaded that there was some public purpose in letting Netanyahu off after he had attacked the judicial system, attacked judges, attacked the administration of justice, had four elections, the purpose of which, of some of them, was that the Likud could go into power, pass legislation, basically granting him immunity. In other words, he was wanted to destroy the whole system of justice in Israel, and you give this guy a pass, like nothing happened? So I discussed with Mitch on the phone, we were bantering different theories. I think we were both saying the same thing, that basically he wanted to be okay with everyone. You know, he wanted to be seen as, on one hand, doing something. On the other hand, there's life after being the Yoetz HaMishpati. He didn't want to perhaps be remembered as the guy who put Netanyahu in jail for 10 years. So let's, you know, we'll have a compromise and make everyone feel happy. I mean, he wasn't the first one. I remember Katsav, our former president, who was a rapist. And people like Avraham Borg said, you know, it's a disgrace for the institution of the presidency to prosecute this person. We'll give him a sweetheart deal. He'll acknowledge it and he'll go away. Of course, he wasn't smart enough to take the deal. He insisted that it was some type of crusade against him, and he was convicted. But I think that this has been, I think, one of the most at least since I've been here in Israel, it's a fairly long time. I think this was a critical, almost deadly makah to our system of justice and democracy and equality within the law. And all it did was it emboldened Netanyahu's allies and like-minded people now and in the future to attack the judicial system. You know, it reminds me to some degree of Trump. Netanyahu and Trump is that the evil people will say, oh, it's really gone over. But the bad things that they've done will outlive them. You know, Trump, his supporters, all these people, all the things that he gave approval to, all the things that people were came under his the Nazis and came under his wings and etc. will live on. And the ethnic the attacks against Ashkenazim, the attacks against the Prakritut, the attacks against the imaginary elitot, the attacks against a free press which discovered these scandals, and if it weren't for a free press, if it wasn't for Haaretz with regard to all the many of these cases, which is bitterly attacked by even mainstream Jews in the United States as being this horrible publication. We wouldn't have found out of all these things. So it's been an enormous damage. And Mendelblit, it's unfathomable that anyone in a position of law enforcement could have taken the position that he did. Mitch, am I exaggerating? Is it?
Well, I think you have a lot of passion, Leon, because you're a lawyer and because you spent your career as a civil servant, you know, upholding the law, protecting the law, fighting inside traitors and regulating, you know, stocks and making sure people were honest and above the law and not outlaws. And here you have a prime minister that not only looks like he behaved like an outlaw and attacked everyone, but, you know, just to show you his brilliance, he demeaned the Aharon Barak, the former chief justice, by getting him involved, getting him in his corner.
Unbelievable.
And then crushing him by not doing a deal. So he lost, you know, his own credibility by being involved. You know, that's something about BB, having worked with him for 4 years. The man has, it's a combination of charisma, and he will just do whatever he thinks and whatever it will take. And it could be that, as you're describing Mendelblit and why is he doing all this, he could have like a Stockholm syndrome, you know. He's like been working close with Netanyahu, and Netanyahu has this kind of hold or charismatic hold on people on the one hand. And I think to the benefit of Netanyahu and Derry, who certainly is guilty, and Litzman, why he wanted to protect a sex offender, although, you know,
he came out with an interview not long after the investigation and said, the Ger Rebbe told me.
The Ger Rebbe, I don't know which one, but from the time of Avram Mandrowitz from Brooklyn, they changed the extradition law, meaning the Ger Rebbe protected, and he's a child molester, and then right. He continued to be a child molester. So they have some hang up, or they have something that they protect these people. I don't know what it is, but there's a track record. But I think also Mendelblit, you know, he sits in on cabinet meetings, so he sees what some of these people do, and they've done good work. You know, Netanyahu has done some good things for Israel, and that may be part of kind of giving them a discount. But I think you are correct to mention that he basically, you know, undermined a lot of the democratic system here, not just the elections, but by attacking the police, by saying, you know, they've made up things and they couldn't bring them down in elections, so they bring them down in the courts, and attacking the court system and even the attorney general. He should have been kind of a little bit more vigilant with him. You know, and I think we also got to see what it would be like the day after if he signed something. The day after he would hold a press conference and say, I didn't do anything wrong. This was a tactic. It's a strategy. I had to do this. It doesn't matter whether he signs it or not. The fact is that the supporters of Netanyahu believe he didn't do anything wrong, even if he, you know, signed that he was involved in the murder of Ro Lazarov. They won't believe it. If he admits to anything, they won't believe it. It's just the corrupt system against him. So he was using that, and he knows who his people are. It's not like he, you know, becomes a state witness or he admits something and he feels like he did something wrong. He doesn't think he did anything wrong. He's only trying to get out of not going to jail and to become prime minister again or to have influence. And I think that's the main problem I was here, is that when it comes to public opinion, he's undermined the people's faith in the people that are enforcing the law. You know, and you put this on top that only in the last few weeks, the Israeli police, are they wiretapping people's phones? Are they using this Pegasus thing? Are they, you know, the justice minister is trying to change the law that you don't need a tzav chipus, you don't need a search warrant if you have just cause. And, you know, to a certain extent, we're viewing this as a police state where the police is in charge of the state on the one hand. And, you know, the attorney general who's supposed to enforce these laws and prosecute the people, you know, are just not doing their job, and they're letting people off too easy. Now, additionally, this has been going on since the time of the gladiators. People love a good hanging. They love a good hanging. They love to see someone rot on a crucifix or rot on the gallows. And that's especially true for, you know, people that have been at the height of their career, people that have been, whether they're prime ministers or presidents, to see them humbled and in prison garb. And I will say that, you know, Ulmer took it like a man. He went to prison. He came out. He talks about these issues. He's, you know, he has criticism of how the, you know, the court did it. And in his case, it was even more sensational because the much of the evidence against him was collected by a private citizen, Sheldon Adelson, who, you know, hired an investigator to find out some things about his real estate deals and to Lansky, and then turned that over to the police. So that was really a case of a private citizen meddling in the affairs because they didn't like his politics. They were too left. So, you know, you don't have that here necessarily, but, you know, you have to have confidence. People have the law. And I think that was lacking in these deals, specific deals, because they weren't seen fit by the people. And, you know, the question is what justice was served.
It's also the elements of, you know, what some of the crimes constituted, besides getting, you know, close to $800,000 in shekels, rather, in Cuban cigars and pink champagne, is, you know, attempting to take over segments of the media, right? Mm-hmm. And then the irony is, of course, they're always saying on the right, you know, the leftist media, the left controls the media, and it was Netanyahu who was trying to really take control over...
Correct.
Over aspects of the media, that's what it was all about. So I think the offenses themselves were, you know, I'm not one to make light. If you have billionaires giving you presents on demand, I don't think that person should be prime minister of Israel. I mean,
well, it's not just those presents. I mean, Netanyahu's friend Dershowitz, who under the late Jeffrey Epstein, and admitted woman, not a young one. But he said that nowhere in the world is favorable media attention a bribe. Right. So this is going to be a first for Israel. That's the question. You know, but they have real solid witnesses. There are 300 of them, including three state witnesses. So I think they're going to lay out a pretty clear case. So it didn't seem right to make a deal with them right when they're in the midst of it.
I think the point that both of you have made... Yeah, you mentioned it in America with Trump as well. You know, the rule of law and the notion of the equality of all men and women, these are very new ideas, both theoretically and practically speaking. You know, the world was not like that for most of the time. For most of human history, there were people who had a right to just kill people or just enslave people or just rape people. And there was no law that they had to answer to. Monarchies worked, and the way absolute rulers worked, and their aristocracy, and the democracy that we grew up in is a chidush. It's an innovation in terms of place in human history. And I used to explain this. I used to say to people, "Look, America, it has this Anglo-Saxon past, and it's many years of the rule of law and the Constitution. It goes back to English." What law? What's it called?
Magna Carta.
Yeah, no, something law. Common law. Back to English. Common law. Israel, you know, most of the people in Israel came from Eastern Europe. They came from North Africa. They don't have a democratic tradition. They don't have a tradition of equality before the law, of the rule of law. So you got to cut us a little slack. And now we see, in America and in Israel, the veneer of the rule of law and that everyone is answerable to the law is in fact a very thin veneer. And it took 4 years of a criminal mastermind being president to take a giant step towards destroying the rule of law in America. I don't know where America's going to end up. I'm very pessimistic. I'm very pessimistic about America. A little bit less pessimistic about Israel for internal political reasons. You know, America is so polarized, it's just simple. I don't know, you know what? It's problematic in both places. And I fear, and in other Western countries we all know, we can all list them, Boris Johnson in England is, you know, different. Obviously, he's not Donald Trump, he's different, but There, too, there are pressures on a lot of notions that we took for granted about equality, about democracy. And I am fearful that our children and grandchildren may, you know, end up in a world where democracy and the rule of law and equality before the law are not as true, are not as common, don't work as well as they did for us during our lifetimes.
Mish, before we close, give me a reason to be optimistic about Israel, that we won't, that we, you know, that the dark forces won't succeed, and some common sense that Netanyahu is maybe a passing episode in Israeli politics, and we'll get back to some form of normal. I said, give me a reason.
I always like to ask this question because, you know, we say we will never, you know, we're here to stay for eternity and God has brought us back. And, you know, we have the Bible as our proof. And, you know, we don't have such a good track record because we've been exiled here twice. Mm-hmm. So if I were the Palestinians or anyone else, I would say three times is a charm. And, you know, we have a track record of the screwing up and being thrown out. And better off when we had the temple and so forth. So I always like to ask the question, are we closer to the third exile or the third temple? And I don't necessarily have a good answer because I think that a lot of the way that, you know, we behave and what we are focusing on and what we've created here to a certain extent, we've had great achievements here. There's no question we've had great achievements. There's no question that in the 70-something years here, it's fantastic. And we do have a bright future, and we do have strength. You know, the thing that I like to say every morning, got the strength, but bless it. And we're not, as long as we're not working there and we're continuing creating strife and continuing divisiveness, we're on our way out here, man. That's it.
I just said what's ironic or troubling is that people on the right, and specifically the religious right, would echo Mitch's, the part that was pessimistic, and blame the left wing. There's the thing that's gonna, if anything, will end our, you know, our the road to Messiah and to redemption, it'll be the progressives and the left wing and the anti-Israel, you know, left wing. Whereas I think, and I think we all in the room might all agree, that it's precisely the radical right, really gone full-scale Trump, I think, in demonizing whole sections of the of Israelis. That if anything's going to louse everything up, I think it's that dynamic in those people. May well be really rooting our chance to, as Rich said, to, you know, build a temple. Well, whatever our vision of a temple is.
Well, look at what the Kotel looks like on Rosh Chodesh every month. We can't even let a group of, you know, women who want to pray get anywhere without, you know, some people attacking them. Yeah. And the fact that you know, cancel culture, if you will, or that unacceptance, or that attitude of our way or the highway, I don't know. Be here? I don't know. I'm not convinced.
Thanks, guys. Hopefully we'll do it again.
On that positive note.
No, we took a long break, and we're not going to do this every week, but we will do it occasionally, and I really want to thank Mitch and Shimon for coming in. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Leon.